This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in philosophy and social theory. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show explores ideas and concepts to better understand how society works. Fuad isn't here this week, but we have a guest. Lee Greaveson is a reader in film studies and director of the postgraduate program in film studies at University College London. Lee, thank you so much for being here. You know, for many people, cinema is just part of our lives, it's part of the backdrop of, the way we entertain ourselves. And very few people, I think, go to cinema with any kind of intellectual baggage or any apparent intellectual baggage. They just appreciate their films and, enjoy it for what they are. Now, when did film develop this other wing, this other dimension to it? So we have film production and we have that whole thing that started off in the US or in France or whatever it is. When did film studies, as opposed to learning how to make films, begin?
Gosh, that's a good question and quite a hard one to answer. It's quite a long history, odd sort of moments of engagement with film. Some of the early investigations of film were really sensorial investigations. They were trying to figure out, what does this thing do to us? It was straightforwardly pretty simple and important question, really. We go to the movies. When it emerged, it sort of mushroomed in the 1910s. And in America, which is the example I know best, a lot of reformers and social scientists started to become interested in this phenomenon that started to develop very quickly, largely because it was appealing to working class and immigrant audiences.
So is this happening before, in the early part of the 20th century, or before the war, or is it
after?
Yeah,
it's early part of the 20th century. It's really mushroomed somewhere around about 1905, 1906.
So very soon after the development of film.
Then we get what's called the phenomenon of Nickelodeons. Nickel is 5 cents and Odeon is a concert hall, very cheap concert halls that you could go to and watch movies. Now, this was really important to working class and immigrant audiences who didn't have a lot of money and couldn't go to very expensive cultural forms, but could go to movies. And for the first time, they were having small amounts of disposable income. And for the first time, job hours were changing in the pressure of industrialization. That meant that they had leisure time. So what did they do with their leisure time? Well, a lot of them went to the movies. And the social scientists and reformers started to think, well, that's a slightly worrying thing. What's happening at the movies? What's going to happen to these people when they go and watch these stories at the movies? So they started to investigate, and that's a form of film studies, right? It's an investigation of the audience. They did lots of various complex investigations. Lots of big ones took place from about 1927 to 1933 in the United States. They were funded by philanthropic money. A lot of very famous social scientists took on tasks to figure out various parts of what was going on. So, for example, one of them was done by psychology professors at the University of Iowa. And what they did is they put kids in front of movies, showed them movies, but they wired their whole bodies up to a machine called a psychogalvanometer.
And that sounds like something out of a science fiction movie itself.
Totally. If you see the pictures, it's astonishing. What you see is a social scientist behind a little kid who's all wired up watching a movie. And what that is measuring is the same technology as lie detectors. Actually, what it's measuring is the changing electronic resistance in your skin. And what they were trying to figure out was, does watching the movie impact upon your kind of emotional system, if you like?
You know, that's fascinating. So, first of all, there's the fact that there are societies in which new social and cultural phenomena get investigated almost instantly, right? That they emerge in society. Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned was, you said social sciences as scientists and reformers.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious about that because, well, I'm imagining people thinking that this might be a bad thing. And so who are these social reformers that looked at cinema and were concerned about it?
That's a really good question. So I'll give you one example, and I'll try to talk a bit more broadly about it. But the Payne Fund studies, which I mentioned, which is philanthropic money financing social scientists at big universities in America, like Chicago, which is in some respects the founding university of sociology in the United States, is founded by a philanthropic organization who are interested in adolescence. And they this whole body is run by a guy called William Shaw, who's a reverend as well as interested in social sciences. He believes cinema's a bad thing, that it's corrupting the youth and taking them away from religion. But what he realizes is, well, I can't just get up and say this again and again. I actually need evidence. I actually need proof. And that's quite an interesting moment because it's a religious argument realizing that it needs the backing of social science in order to be really listened to and entertained anymore. That we should regulate movies because we can prove empirically that it will impact upon our children's behavior, conduct, emotional understanding of the world. So there were a large numbers of, you know, in the early 20th century, the moment of modernity, there were large numbers of people who are anxious about the transformations that are taking place. I mean, that's really the moment when the catalytic transformations take place, when urbanization takes place, industrialization takes place, mass production takes place, consumerism takes place. All of this is in a kind of crucible of the early 20th century period. And there are lots of reformers and lots of smart academics, interested people, public intellectuals who are observing these transformations and worrying about the direction of the future in some respects.
I know that cinema came to Asia very early on. I mean, just a couple of years after it kind of opened in the West, as it were, it was already in India. Yep. I actually know somebody who was a grandchild of some Parsi entrepreneurs who, you know, had cinemas all across the British Empire.
Yeah.
And I do know also there's been some research about discussions about cinema in colonial Malaya. For instance, you know, the image of the Westerner that's not the model of empire, right?
Yeah.
So the American who gets drunk or fornicates or this and that, and there was these discussions in Malayan papers about whether this would foster communism, because to show the Westerner, the white man, as flawed would actually embolden the Asian.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, this is the kind of things that you were looking at as well, I mean, that you look at in your work?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the way in which states try to use and control media is really crucial to what I do in my work, really. That's kind of the big question I'm interested in. How do states and powerful institutions, like corporations, use media to try to influence the conduct of people for purposes that benefit their own goals? So that example you mentioned there, which is this concern about colonized audiences watching movies that show misbehaving white folk, therefore decreasing the respect that those colonized people should feel for those colonial white folk, is an absolutely crucial one for the British Empire. As a sensorial object, you know, cinema becomes really a great concern, because American movies in particular, which tell very different stories, American movies are really, you know, aren't predicated on the system of hierarchy that was crucial to the British Empire, broadly speaking, but also a British class structure. American movies, because they're basically born as a kind of liberal individualist narrative, tell stories that are somewhat at odds with that. So British state and British sensorial bodies were very anxious about, well, what would it mean if you've got your subaltern populations watching these narratives about individuals striving to achieve their own unique individual freedom? That's not great for a colonial power. So there was a lot of censorship across the British Empire from there's a very famous Censorship Act passed in 1927, which is directly aimed at that, trying to limit the circulation of movies showing American produce, American materials, but also characters not behaving in ways that would require the respect of our colonized populations.
Two very interesting dimensions that you've already, you know, kind of like mentioned in passing. One, of course, is the reception end of cinema, you know, the person in the audience, right? So the studies are about, you know, sweat on your arms or whatever.
Yeah.
You have palpitations. I don't know what it is when you watch a movie. But the other is actually the content of the film, and in how maybe censors would look at a film and see whether it was appropriate for the audience. So two different directions in which film studies, in fact, in some ways, might go, right? I mean, in the early part, which is the audience reception dimension, and the other is the content dimension. I mean, can I just ask you a personal question? I mean, how and why did you get into studying film when you did?
Well, there were some lazy aspects to it, really. There was some straightforward lazy aspects. I was a literature student, and I was reading lots of 18th century and 19th century novels, which were incredibly long. I don't know if you know some of those epistolary novels in particular, which are sort of letter novels of letters being sent back and forth. And I realized that it was just taking me, you know, days and days and days to get through these things. And I thought, well, you could probably study a movie much quicker than I can study a 19th century novel.
What? Oh, hold on. Is Dracula, wasn't it an epistory? Wasn't it, was about sending telegrams back and forth and stuff like that?
Yeah, a lot of those 19th century novels have some aspects in it, but some of the earlier ones, like I'm thinking about sort of Clarissa in particular, which was a sort of huge book stop of a novel. It probably to do with the temporality of the 18th century and the 19th century, which is very different than cinema is a kind of modern form in some respects. So it partly does kind of bring experience to within a much kind of faster modernity in some respects. But so I started as a slightly flippant answer, but it's the sense in which I was sort of trained in a particular way, and that was sort of think about culture as a sort of ideological force. And it seemed to me increasingly that while the ideological forces that we face today are from mass media, from popular media, they're not really literary. Literature isn't an absolutely crucial defining ideological structure of our current society. But cinema and the mass media that it begets, which goes from radio to television to digital media and follows from cinema in some respects, is, I think, you know, absolutely crucial to the ideological structuring of the 20th century, of the American century in some respects. So, my concern to study that was a concern to study a form that I felt had particular ideological power. And that broadly speaking, I mean, that was sort of where I began. But then one starts to think more carefully about, well, how does ideology function? What is ideology? How can we understand the actual function of mass media? And that's become increasingly important to me.
So, okay. So for somebody who perhaps still is kind of unsure about what film studies does, it seems like there are many different types of methodologies that you can use. I mean, you can have a kind of close reading of a film, and you could also do something much more sociological.
Yeah.
Or even in the instance that you bring up about the Reverend, who uses a much more kind of positivistic kind of approach.
Yeah.
I mean, he's measuring things. He wants to trying to. And how successful was he? I mean, could give us a sense of what he did in fact come up with.
Well, that's a particular example. I'll sort of talk a little bit about that example. So that's sort of circling on your first question was, how does cinema studies begin? And we can go further from that. But it, in some respects, to my mind, it begins. I edited a book called Inventing Film Studies, which was about the history of the discipline, trying to think about different ways in which this discipline began and where different pockets of it, that eventually it became the thing that it became in universities around about the 1970s. But it started in that moment, I think, when people started thinking, well, what is this thing? How can we understand it? How does it impact upon people? And lots of studies get published. And then this philanthropic money finances 10 books that are published in 1933 by Macmillan, and they're called the Payne Fund Studies. The guy who organized it initially was called Reverend William Short. Some very significant social scientists at Yale, at Chicago, at Iowa, Indiana, at these big kind of research-intensive universities in the United States are working on it. And they do various studies, and one of them was that kind of psychological investment. One of them was to see if it impacted upon sleep patterns. So they wired children's beds and saw if they tossed and turned more, if they watched movies other than if they didn't watch movies before they went to bed.
Well, they had a nightmare having watched Jaws.
Exactly. Well, it was a bit earlier than that, but yeah, watch Charlie Chaplin or something. So that's a very kind of, you know, an attempt to really kind of, as you say, kind of positivistically, empirically document the impact. Some of the others were more broad-based and were more about people writing about their experiences going to the movies. But some of that goal at that point in time was to ally movies with appreciation, literary appreciation, which had emerged and was a sign of some kind of civilized, you know, individual, that you might appreciate a novel. Well, it started to become relevant that you could appreciate a film, that maybe film could be seen as a sort of form of art as well. So, for example, the Museum of Modern Art for the first time establishes a film studies division in 1935. And that's a real moment when it suddenly seems like, well, that means that film is sort of part of art. It can be thought about as a form of art. So there's a long tradition and history there of people thinking about movies as novels, as art forms, as any kinds of that gets done in the humanities, thinking about close readings or themes, and that becomes sort of quite significant to what was a form of film studies as a sort of literary appreciation. It's not a form of film studies that I feel fond of or have any particular time for, but it was in the history of the discipline that became important. what took place, if we're tracing the history of the discipline from that moment, and I'm talking there, you know, a kind of form of literary filmic appreciation starting in the 30s, but developing through the 1950s in particular, and it starts to become some university courses where you might be in an English department, but you might take a class of film appreciation and watch some film masters and think about them similar, perhaps, to how you might think about novelists. What took place, and you'll know this more from your sort of social theory background, is in the 60s and 70s, it's kind of quite radical ferment of disciplines that takes place, partly, you know, motivated by a baby boom generation, which starts to become more critical. So there starts to become feminism, and there starts to become civil rights and black power studies, and then there starts to become queer studies. And so a lot of kind of sort of more radical studies emerge, which want to think about ideological forms in our society. And within that, film studies becomes really significant. And it's partly because it is an ideological state apparatus, if you follow Louis Althusser's definitions. Louis Althusser is a, you know, Marxist philosopher who thought about ideological state apparatuses and how they shape us, and he says culture is one of them, media is one of them. Well, many of those people in the 1970s who started thinking about film really started to think about this thing as an ideological state apparatus which positions you in particular ways to be subservient to particular power formations. And really crucial to that was feminists. Feminists were absolutely crucial to that.
Okay, we're going to have to come back with more. I mean, clearly you brought us to the point of a revival. Once you are a course at university, well, nothing needs to be said. You're not going to be attacked by social reformers concerned about whether children are going to wet their beds after watching a scary movie, or Chaplin, for that matter. I've been speaking to Lee Greaveson. He is reader in film studies and director of the graduate program in film studies at University College London. I'm Sharad Kutan. You're listening to Night School, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and Night School continues with our guest, Lee Greaveson. He is reader in film studies and director of the graduate program in film studies at University College London. We were talking about the development of film studies, its trajectory from the early part of the 20th century into the 70s, when, you know, everything from Marxism to gender studies to race and, I guess, psychoanalysis would impact the way film is studied. But I wanted perhaps stop there for a while and sort of consider the other flow. I mean, did film studies in any way shape film production? Did it change the way filmmakers thought about their own work?
No, I don't think so, straightforwardly. I don't think it's impacted upon commercial film production in quite that way. So there's two ways of answering that. One, firstly, it has impacted upon avant-garde artistic filmmaking and those traditions which emerge. So one quick example, one of the very brilliant and famous feminist scholars who wrote about cinema in that 70s moment, Laura Mulvey, wrote a very famous essay called Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema. It's very famous across the humanities, really, because it's an account of how cinema is almost structured sort of materially and ideologically through a kind of male gaze, which is straightforwardly patriarchal, misogynistic. She was also a filmmaker. So she was making films which tried to interact with her theoretical perspectives and tried to sort of generate different forms of seeing, different forms of viewing and engaging with the film object. That's quite a common trend, actually, across the history of film studies and film production. So you think of someone like Sergei Eisenstein, who's a famous Russian Soviet filmmaker who made a number of very significant films in the 1920s, but was also a theorist. He was also thinking about film. He was writing about film at the same time as he was making film. So were a number of other famous filmmakers on a kind of avant-garde political level. So there's a very famous movement that's called Third Cinema. I'm not sure how much you know of that,
no,
but it emerges in Latin America in the 1960s, and it's a Marxist ideological critique of cinema as an ideological force, as mainstream cinema as being a form of American imperialism. And it's a critique, and they also make films which seek to challenge that language and that rhetoric and that economic and political argument. One of the most famous of them is called An Hour of the Furnaces, made by Fernando Solanas and Octavio Gattino, two Argentinian filmmakers of the 1960s, who wrote a very famous polemic essay as they made the film. And they would show the film in political surroundings, so like a political meetings or clandestine meetings, because they were living under a dictatorship. So they were using film as a political object, and they were thinking about how film was an ideological form and how you could make film to engage and revolutionize a mass audience, which is what Eisenstein was doing to some extent, which is what the third cinema post-colonial filmmakers were doing to some extent, which is what feminist filmmakers were doing to some extent. We're thinking about film, and a number of black groups were, you know, thinking very carefully about film, but also making film. So that aspect went hand in hand. But in terms of the corporate industry, there became film production schools, which became increasingly significant to kind of training of filmmakers like people like George Lucas or Steven Spielberg from that kind of generation. So baby boom generation, who watched lots of movies on television, became cinephiles, went to film production schools, and there were some kind of significant ones in the U.S., in particular USC, UCLA, and NYU. People like Martin Scorsese went there. Who were thinking about film in some of these ways and were probably reading some film studies, but were more production-based students. And then that's a whole tradition now and a kind of lucrative form for universities.
So, okay, so there is the kind of mainstream narrative, Hollywood-styled films that we get and we all probably understand more than or exposed to more than we are of these alternatives, these attempts to break with, or even that older tradition that came from a very different place, Eisenstein, Vertov, all those people, right? Now, what is the power of the American cinema style that we've come, or that, you know, linear narrative style that we've come to understand, in fact, define film as being, you know?
Well, that's a $64,000 question. I mean, it's a hard question to answer. What is the power? It's certainly something that I've been thinking about and something that I think is really significant. I think it's a sort of very complex distillation, to my mind, into form of a particular form of political economy, which is sort of liberal, capitalist, individualist, connected to a consumer economy in quite significant ways. And the translation of that complex ideological object into a form has worked best for various complex reasons in American mass cinema. It did work best historically. So one of the ways to answer that as well is you trace that out historically. American movies were not always globally dominant, and to some extent they're not dominant in many markets, but through a concatenation of events, they do become dominant by around about the First World War, and the First World War plays a role, but it's not the defining role, whereby other industries become damaged. American becomes increasingly prominent kind of politically and economically across the world, and its media culture does as well. So from that point on, Hollywood starts to become quite dominant. The American state helps support Hollywood, circulate their movies. They establish particular institutions in the 1920s, the American state, which works with the Hollywood corporate studios to circulate the movies. And the state's working on the straightforward assumption, which I think is totally true and correct, they're not idiots, that the more they can get American films around the world, the more people will want American things that they see in those movies. They're seductive. They're sort of like display windows. And the more in which American ideals, which is really a word for sort of free trade economic transactions, can circulate across the world. So America state is works very hard in lowering protectionist tariffs for culture and media. And it's doing that consistently because it works on the assumption that the more it can get its media in front of your eyes, in front of all our eyes, the better it is for its political economic situation. So it's a battle for our attention. And American movies have done that pretty well.
Did the Cold War really, give a boost to that dynamic that you just talked about?
Oh, absolutely. The Cold War was absolutely crucial to that kind of orchestration of culture as a form of ideological weapon. Right? So the Cold War is effectively an image war. It's a symbol war. It's a war of images. And in that, you need Hollywood on your side explaining how liberal capitalism is really the answer and how this will be freedom. Now, you could actually specific examples of this, which is fascinating to my mind. So we know now, for example, that the CIA actually had a fund to try to influence Hollywood to introduce the theme of freedom, quotation marks around it, into as many Hollywood movies as they could in the 1950s, because this was a way of which to try to globalize American message. It was called a militant liberty program, whereby they tried to influence filmmakers in Hollywood to be more open to free market idealism.
But that sounds like a recipe for propaganda.
Totally, it is. It's a propaganda network. Hollywood is a form of propaganda, I think.
But don't think that's counterintuitive? I mean, we often think of communist China, the Soviet Union is producing propaganda, maybe Nazi Germany, you know, Leni Riefenstahl. That's propaganda. But Hollywood's just stories about people and, you know, the stuff that Uma, you know, Ambika Paken, you know, of the Evening Edition loves. I mean, you know, and his shows, they celebrate life. It's not propaganda, is it?
No, it's totally propaganda. I believe Hollywood to be an extraordinarily powerful form of propaganda, and I think propaganda and propaganda theorists, of which I can talk about, and emerged in the 1920s, and I'll tell you how in a moment. Propaganda theorists say propaganda works best when you don't think it's propaganda. Straightforwardly, it's always at its most productive when you don't understand it as propaganda. Now, let me tell you the brief history again, because I'm a sort of historian, so apologies, but I always go back to the past. The First World War was the first war when film was used as a propaganda tool. And the United States, who joined the war in 1917, 3 years after it began, set up immediately upon established joining the war an enormous propaganda organization called the Committee of Public Information. This used cinema as absolutely central to its propaganda goals, produced films, had cinemas themselves used as propaganda sort of stations, lots of posters, recruiting stations. And it learned some of the techniques as to how Hollywood stars and Hollywood movies can be used to help persuade people to do something. Now, what they were trying to persuade them to do was support the war, but that wasn't just abstractly support the war, but also buy Liberty bonds in particular. So you needed to buy bonds in able to finance the war at that particular time. And lots of film stars go out on tours and make films about this. And they realized this was really, really successful. After the war happened, a number of people reflected on what had happened and thought straightforwardly that was astonishingly successful. We used this modern mass media to try to persuade people to do something and of the rightness of our arguments, which were not necessarily right, and it turned out they believed us. So a lot of people, very smart people, reflected on this. And to the smart theorist who you might know from your social theory background is a guy called Walter Lippmann, who's a very famous sort of public intellectual in the United States. And he wrote a number of books in the 1920s about propaganda, where he, who had actually worked in the Committee of Public Information briefly in 1917, 1918, reflected on this and suddenly realized, wow, you know, actually we can. And he uses the famous phrase that Noam Chomsky comes back to again and again. He says, we manufactured consent. We manufactured people agreeing with our perspective that it was a good idea to enter the war.
Don't you think people would object to that? They're saying, well, no, you're thinking I'm some sort of cultural robot. You program me, you put me in front of a screen, you know, and I will respond in the way that you have kind of constructed. Isn't that assuming that people don't have agency, they don't have power to make decisions, they don't have the ability to be critical and step back?
Yeah, well, you're a social theorist. You're interested in agency. How much do advertisers spend a year? It's not even possible for you and I to come up with a figure.
Gazillions
of dollars, yeah. On the assumption that what you're watching will influence how you might behave.
Sure.
Now, that's a lot of money. I'm assuming if they assume that it's totally a waste of their time to do that, they've got better uses for their money. Now, I think that media does influence, and it might not influence us on that knee-jerk, oh, I'm going to now go out and buy an Apple computer, but it influences in the broad understanding of how we interact with our world and what our world is. And the repetitive nature of the fact that all of our media is basically commercial media. It's media which is only there mostly because it's trying to bring us next to advertisers. That's how commercial media forms tend to work. And that's a historical process as well. You can trace that. How does that happen, that media becomes a form of helping commercial capital? But I think it works very precisely. I think there are many examples of that. And we can go back to those kind of pain fund studies talks we were talking about in the earlier part of our conversation, whereby people were trying to figure out, what does this thing do? Nobody could figure out very precisely what this thing does. But it seems to me naive to assume that if you spend, as studies suggest most of us do, 7 or 8 hours in front of screens of some form these days, that those screens do not influence you in some way or other. I think that they probably do.
Okay, so the question is, so you have, this critical apparatus that, you know, theoreticians are developing in order to fight this, right? In order to kind of find a way around it or to see gaps in it and suggest that this ideological project is not monolithic. Yeah. That it, in fact, it probably has and is fractured or is there to be undermined if we only understood it better, right? That we can, in fact, fight this machine.
Yeah.
I mean, do you believe that?
That's a very good question. I don't think we've got any option, really. I mean, this is my own opinion. I should straightforwardly that I do think that media has been used to develop forms of economic imperialism historically that have been deeply damaging to people, planets, environments, ecosystems, and so on. And that has continued and intensified. And I think that it is our task to try to understand how media, my task, perhaps, to try to understand how media has played a central role in helping orchestrate political economies, which have been deeply damaging to our worlds. And if we don't understand how media plays a role in that, I don't think we can change that, because I think media is absolutely crucial to how that works. I mean, 708 corporations own about 85% of American media. Now, that strikes me, that just one simple statistic, that's profoundly worrying. If small, large corporations own your media, then your public sphere, your chance of debating some of the crucial issues that face us as a community and a species is radically narrowed. For example, if General Electric, which did own NBC, General Electric are an incredibly large arms manufacturer, how likely do you think NBC are going to be discussing the arms budget and making a case for reducing the fact that America spends more than any other country combined on its arms industry? Very unlikely, right?
But, you know, so somebody will say, well, actually, if you look at Hollywood, there are these stories of resistance against large corporations, there's suspicion about the state, in fact, you know, federal government, of people wanting to take over, and they plant the seeds of radical thought in people's minds because they give us these stories. And in fact, you know, Hollywood is not afraid to, you know, celebrate the life of a Nelson Mandela. I'm sure there's one day going to be a story about Malala, you know. I mean, whatever it is, isn't Hollywood also giving us those stories of struggle and resistance against, you know, Big Brother?
That's a good question. I haven't seen many of those. I think it's sort of axiomatic that a large corporate industry cannot be a productive force for a world that needs to strip corporations of its powers. So I don't think that we're going to find the seeds for a future transformation of this world, if there is such a possibility, through a corporately produced media. That's my opinion. I think if you want to find that, you find that elsewhere, and you don't find it through media produced by large corporations, financed by finance capital, and supported by what has been the most violent and aggressive state in the 20th century, in the 21st century. So my sense is that I feel a bit less optimistic that Hollywood's going to help us on this one.
Is it all Brave New World and feelies then, you know, this machine that in which we are plugged in and which feeds us our desires, but at a particular level, and so calibrated for us never to kind of reject it?
I'm sorry to say that I sort of think it's similar to that, yes.
Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Okay. Now, okay. Do you look at the margins? Do you look at filmic traditions that kind of resist?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned some earlier when we talked, you know, there's a line of them in some respects, and many of these people read and think about each other's work. So the Third Cinema people were reading Eisenstein and thinking about what were Soviet filmmakers doing with film. Same with the documentary filmmakers to some extent in the 30s and 40s. There's a sort of urge to sort of document reality, to make films that are about the real world, not fictional worlds. So there are outsides, I think, and I think, I know you're anxious to get in, but I think there's a... there's a flourishing online documentary culture whereby people are sharing things on YouTube. For example, in the recent so-called Arab Spring, which I don't think is quite the correct name, but nevertheless, the revolutions in the Arab world, there was a lot of use of film. If you think of film broadly as people documenting what was taking place in front of them, and also filmmakers making films about what was taking place in the revolution. So I think that there are ways in which film can be utilized and has been utilized by progressive forces. And some of that's about witnessing and documenting. Right, so some of the stuff that you see from, let's say, the Egyptian revolution are people showing state violence in action. Here I'm showing somebody, some police officers, some army people beating and killing these protesters. That seems to me a powerful use of film. It's a use of film to witness the brutality of state power. And because of this new digital interconnected media that we live in, you can upload that to YouTube and 15 minutes later, I can watch it in London, you can watch it in Kuala Lumpur, and it can be a kind of potentially global collective can emerge around that.
But does it have the potential to disrupt the very terms in which these things are being made? I mean, is this just, okay, it's going to help, activists in the Middle East, and it's going to help people here and there, but it doesn't in fact change the very nature of the way in which images are produced and read and the architecture that supports it?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, you raise a question sort of form in some respects there. So one of the questions might be, and it has been in film studies, one of the questions that, going back to that sort of core line of your questioning, is what has been the history of the discipline of film studies. Well, one of those, what happened in that 1970s moment that we were talking about briefly a moment ago was the idea that the form that got established at a particular moment, and you could date it, it's around about 1915, 1916, it's a so-called, I guess often called classical Hollywood cinema. It's a particular kind of narrative form. It's a three-act structure, usually has one hero, it's usually a boy, a man, who follows a sort of journey with obstacles in the way, and at the end of it, they usually realize their goals, and it ends happily, and along that way, usually they've hooked up with a woman. That's roughly speaking what classical Hollywood does. It starts at, you can date when it emerges as a feature film, that's about 2 hours, 90 minutes to 2 hours. One of the arguments that got made by film studies, which I so profoundly believe in, is that that form itself is ideological, that the form itself is content to some extent, and it's about individualism, it's about striving for particular kinds of goals, it's a certain kind of heterosexual narrative, it's in some respects quite similar to sort of liberal 19th century novel narratives. So the form itself is ideological. Then one of the questions is, well, should we be challenging to change that form? That's one of the questions that feminists were particularly engaged in, for example. So some of that was a question of, well, we really need to fundamentally transform this narrative order in order to produce a form that will allow women to exist outside of a kind of patriarchal system. Now I've got some sort of residual engagement in that, but I actually don't think that really what we really need to do is shatter form in some respects. I think we probably need to shatter the institutions that now support those forms. I think those forms are ideological, but they're entrenched, and it's really the kind of corporations that we need to be. It's really questions of ownership, and questions of the kind of continual understanding of film as a commercial object rather than as an artistic or cultural or engaged object that needs to be challenged.
Okay, we've come to that point in the show where we look to you for suggestions. Of course, you have many books, and we're going to post this on our Facebook page. You know, you have Policing Cinema, Movies and Censorship in the Earlier 20th Century. We have your co-editor of a six-volume reader, the Silent Cinema Reader. You have something called Mob Cultures. So I'm not going to ask you to recommend those things because that would sound like self-promotion, though we allow self-promotion on this show. What would you recommend to somebody who's starting out, who can't read Christian Metz, so one of those really heavy theoretical books on cinema, who might be a bridge to understanding the theoretical and conceptual kind of concerns that film studies academics bring to the phenomena?
That's a very good question. It's hard to think of a single book that would do that, I suppose. There are accounts of the history of the discipline, if people want to follow up on some of that in terms of what our conversation has been. There's a great book about that kind of the emergent moment in the 1970s by a friend of mine called David Roderick called The Decline of political modernism, or it could be the crisis of political modernism. And it's about the emergence of that political formation of cinema studies and its transformation in the 1980s. A book I edited, co-edited with my friend Heidi Wasson, called Inventing Film Studies, is a collection of essays which looks very closely at the discipline across its history and tries to figure out when it emerges, when it changed, why it changed. Particularly, I should say, in Anglo-American circles in particular, we're not kind of broadly looking at a kind of global picture of that book at that moment in time.
Anything from the Third World that you recommend? Are you familiar with?
Yeah. Well, I think all of us should read the essay Towards a Third Cinema by Octavio Gattino and Fernando Solanas, who are the third cinema filmmakers that I mentioned. That's widely anthologized. You can find it online very easily. It's called Towards a Third Cinema. Mm-hmm. And it's an argument for cinema in the so-called third world being a kind of radical productive force. It's a short essay, but incredibly productive and interesting. There's a lot of, if your listeners are interested in pursuing some of that, the keywords will be third cinema, relating to the third world as it was theorized at that point in time in the 70s. And there's a lot of really interesting work that's being produced there from post-colonial scholars and filmmakers about thinking about cinema as a way, as a sort of imperial technology. But they're thinking, well, how do we reuse that? How do we challenge that? How do we transform that? How do we use this technology for purposes of post-colonial struggle?
I'd recommend something I'd recommend the film, and I can ask you to recommend some films as well. Kidlat Tahimik's, I think, Perfume Nightmares, which Frederick Jameson, sort of American literary scholar, Marxist, tries to read. And that might be a nice thing. You know, watch the film. I don't know where you would get it. I watched it actually in the Philippines in an extraordinary showing of the film with Kidlat himself, the filmmaker, and doing a performance as well. After the film actually started to burn, it was a strange moment. And he writes about this. So Frederick Jameson writing about Kidlat Tahimik's documentary, a sort of documentary about development. Film. Since we are talking about films, what film about film would you recommend?
Okay, let me be shamelessly self-plugging here momentarily, which is connected to your question. I was a part of a project which was trying to get together all the films made by the British colonial state and some of its corporate partners during a period of British colonialism. We put a lot of those films online, which is available at colonialfilm.org. And there's a number of those films that actually deal with colonial Malaya. So there's a number of films from the 30s, 40s, and 50s that are produced in colonial Malaya and about the Malayan situation and the Malayan emergency, for example. So they might be of interest to some of your listeners in particular. And they're freely available online, produced in the 30s, 40s, 50s, mostly the Malayan material. There's lots of other material. And there's about 35 hours of freely available digitized film made.
What's the website?
It's called colonialfilm.org. Colonial Film, you'll find it quite easily. Now, films about films, gosh. I tend to watch documentaries, I'll be honest with you. I don't really watch that much fiction.
Videograms of the Revolution. Do you know that one?
I don't.
About the Romanian Revolution. Done by a German documentary filmmaker who died last year, whose name escapes me now. But yeah, we'll put this online, and maybe one of the things we can do is, as things come to mind,
sure,
documentaries that you
sure
like.
There's a lot of great documentaries. There's been a lot of great I think perhaps some of the best works being produced in documentary now. I mean, The Act of Killing, which you probably
Oppenheimer know. Is it?
Yeah, Joshua Oppenheimer about Indonesia. I think it's probably one of the most extraordinary films that I've seen in the last 5 or 10 years. And I think there are a number of online documentaries as well, which are really challenging, pushing the medium form and forward and really thinking carefully about how to use cinema in productive, progressive ways.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to allow you to write to Lee via our email. So it's bfmnightschool@gmail.com, or you can engage with him on Facebook. Are you on Facebook?
No, I'm afraid I'm not.
Okay, are you on Twitter?
I'm afraid I'm not really.
Okay, so what we'll do is, you do have an email.
I have an email address, sure.
So he has an email address, and we'll forward questions or comments that you have to him.
Sure.
And he, yeah, thank you.
I'll be happy to respond.
Yeah, so, and maybe we can even ask him to give us a kind of a viewing list, maybe the 10 top documentaries that he thinks you must watch in order to have a sense. You
I
do?
Could do that, definitely.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. So thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Lee Greaveson. He's reader in film studies and director of the graduate program in film studies at University College London. Here in Malaysia, he's joined me. I'm Sharad Kutan. This has been Night School, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.